countries. But I think we can start fighting and maybe like a regional force, something more autonomous, no agreements between the Amazonical countries like Brazil, Colombia, Venezuela, Peru, even Bolivia, to start getting coordination with the armed forces, the police forces, also environmental authorities to fight more strongly, the illegal activities, mining, logging, the narcotics also, no narcotraffic. These activities are destroying very rapidly most of the Amazonical environment. So I think we can start with that. Then we have to also make some agreements about the what is called here extractivismo. No, what Petro also talks about that, about how to reduce the extraction of oil in the Amazonical region, also that made a lot of mess and disasters, ecological disasters. So I think there is a path. It's a very difficult task, I think, because our countries here are in this struggle between economical development and growing and the environmental protection. That's a very huge and difficult struggle in this global capitalism we live on. I think we have to discuss this very carefully and seeing how to also protect the way of development of each country also, no?
Well, thank you very much, Lucho.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank our assistant producer, Alicia Vargas, for her editing of today's show. I'd like to thank our board op, Gary Baca, and also thank the Alliance for Global Justice, in particular, their Echo Solidarity series. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. You all please stay well and
You're
safe.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kbu.fm.
Here at KBOO, we'll be kicking off our winter drive on February 20th, which happens to be National Love Your Pet Day. Isn't this a heartwarming and fun holiday? We want to ask you to please record a short 1 to 2 minute audio or as long as a 10 minute audio explaining your relationship with your animal family. Share experiences as well as value of relationship and any other interesting or powerful story. The animals in our life bring us incomparable companionship. Whether a cat, dog, parrot, horse, or any other beloved pet, humans have developed incredible bonds with their animal counterparts. We want to hear your experiences with your pets, and most importantly, how much you love them and how they have made your life better. Send your audio to publicaffairs@kboo.org with the subject line Pet Day. You can also call the station at 503-231-8032 and choose voicemail box 302 and go ahead and record your story. If you ever experience the loss of an animal friend, you're welcome to share how you felt and how it changed you to lose that beloved friend and ally. An unfortunate downside to the blessing of the friendship they provide is the almost inevitable goodbye that comes when our dear friends' lifespans are far shorter than our own. With this being said, on February 20th, we want to take pause and celebrate our animal friends with National Love Your Pet Day. A toast in honor of our beloved animal friends, those who are with us, as well as those gone to the spirit worlds. So remember, send your audio to publicaffairs@kboo.org with the subject line Pet Day, or you can also call the station at 503-231-8032 and choose voicemail box 302 and go ahead and record the story. Thank you.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 33rd annual Cascade Festival of African Films throughout the month of February with a collection of films by African directors from over 16 nations.
Films will be screened at Cascade PCC, Hollywood Theater, and virtually. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
That's the 33rd Annual Cascade Festival of African Films, showing Africa through African lenses, happening February 3rd until Saturday, March 4th, in celebration of Black History Month. Full schedule and location information can be found at africanfilmfestival.org.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Series, continuing Saturday, February 18th, with fingerstyle guitarist Cray Van Kirk. Van Kirk plays a bit of everything when it comes to folk and sings new stories for the 21st century. The Folk Music Series continues Saturday, February 18th at 7:30 in the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steel Street in Portland. Check it out at kboo.fm under Community Events.
What does the average KBOO listener think of self-help radio?
This is so hard and complicated.
I have no idea what it is.
What's this old-time music?
I feel so proud of myself.
Seems kind of worthless.
Why does it have to make so much noise?
It sounds very hipster.
That's the worst thing.
Look at how humanity has used their intellect.
Self-Help Radio, a different theme explored with music and talk every week. Tuesdays, midnight to 3 a.m. on KBOO Portland.
Hey, Michael here. I'm with the Tin Can Phone Podcast, a radio show where you can hear about the influence incarceration has straight from the source. We tell you the story from the inside out. So make sure to check us out on KBOO Community Radio every first Tuesday at 10 a.m.
What's up, everybody? This is Goddess, and she, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. A few months ago, former district attorney, Chesa Boudine, made history in charging a police officer in the San Francisco Police Department for the murder of Keita O'Neill. He was shot and killed by a rookie officer in 2017. And the case caused a lot of controversy because he was unarmed. The headlines from that said he was a carjacker, he was a criminal, and with those headlines it implied that whatever he got, he deserved. Yeah. Just on a side note, there was a recent tragedy that took place in San Francisco with a house being blown up. Yeah. And when they arrested the gentleman who they accuse of maybe running some sort of drug lab. His name is Price. When you looked on some of the early papers around that, they had a picture of Keita. If you didn't know who he was, you would have thought that Keita was a drug dealer involved in the blowing up of that house. Now, those pictures have been since removed, but they left them there with the implication and the implying. So this is 4 years after, or 5 or 6 years after his death, and we still have the dragging of him in the mud. So Chesa, welcome to the show. Let's talk about this, because now what we've seen is Brooke Jenkins, who currently is the district attorney, has dropped the case, angering the family, angering the community, and she blames you, for the officer even being charged, said you did it for political reasons. There was no reason for this officer to be charged. You've been pretty outspoken about that. Let's break down this case and what happened.
Well, as you point out, Davey, this is a case in which Mr. O'Neill was a suspect in a carjacking. And I want to be very clear. If the police had done the job, if they'd arrested him instead of killing him, then the district attorney's office would have appropriately prosecuted him for that case. But we don't have the death penalty. We don't believe in extrajudicial killing in this country. And what the police officer did to Mr. O'Neill that day was not only criminal, it was also a violation of Mr. O'Neill's civil rights and a violation of training and police practice policy. How do we know that? Well, because the officer was fired almost immediately for shooting his handgun through the window of a moving patrol car. They're not supposed to do that for very obvious and good reasons. So he gets fired by the police department. Then in a civil lawsuit, the city attorney recommends and the city settles a civil lawsuit for millions of dollars with his family because he was wrongfully killed. His life was wrongfully taken. And then when my office presented a judge with a warrant saying that we believed a crime had been occurred, a homicide, a judge reviewed the facts and signed that arrest warrant initiating a criminal case. That was back in 2020. Since then, the district attorney that the mayor appointed, Jenkins, has conspired with the defense counsel in the case, the police officer association lawyers that are representing the officer, to delay even a preliminary hearing, to delay a public presentation of the facts. I put on my Twitter just a clip of the body cam footage. And what you can see is an unarmed Keita O'Neill is running on foot. And as he runs past the patrol car, which is still moving, the officer takes his gun out and through the window, as Mr. O'Neill is running behind him, the officer shoots him, bullet ends up hitting him in the neck, almost coming from behind, because the officer was shooting him after he had passed by the window of the patrol car, of the still moving car. This is a case that absolutely deserves to be heard by a jury. This is a case in which San Franciscans deserve to say whether or not we condone and tolerate this kind of extrajudicial assassination of an unarmed Black man. And Jenkins is desperate to come up with excuses for why she won't prosecute it. And we know what the bottom line is. She's bought and paid for by the police union and by the billionaires that are apologists for police brutality. And so rather than have a public hearing, she's trying to scapegoat me to divert attention from what I think we all know about her at this point. She will not hold everyone equally accountable. She is deeply politically motivated, and she does not care at all about victims of police violence.
What is the excuse given, considering the mountain of evidence, as you laid out? The police fired the officer immediately, said it was a violation of policy. The city settled for $2.5 million, and a judge signed off. What's the excuse for overlooking that? Those are three different bodies of people, right? that are coming to the conclusion what took place was wrong.
Yeah. And you don't need to be an expert or a judge to look at the video and know that what happened was wrong. What happened was absolutely wrong. It's not how things are supposed to be done. And when someone uses a firearm and takes life in a way that's unlawful in this country, in this city, in my office, when I was district attorney, we prosecuted that. But in Jenkins' office, it's different. There's a different standard. Police can steal, lie, and even kill with impunity when she's the district attorney. And there really are two systems of justice, one for the powerful and the well-connected and one for everybody else. So what are their excuses? How do they justify it? Well, first of all, she's saying it's political, that we filed the case for political reasons. You know, it's funny. I don't even know what that means. I'm looking at a video of somebody shooting and killing an unarmed man, and there's nothing political about that to me. This is a murder. This is a homicide. We prosecute that. Now, we understand the political context, of course, of race and police violence in this country. But all you need to do is look at a video and see that an officer shot his gun from a moving car through a window at an unarmed man. It hit him in the back of the neck and killed him. It's not political. That's a crime. You look at that video and you see a crime. It's a homicide. But she's saying it's political because she doesn't want to prosecute it. And really, the one who's being political, ironically, is her. She's being political because her bread is buttered by the police union and their backers. The second thing they're saying, and this is a little bit more complicated, but it's important to understand and to break down. So they're saying that at some point after Mr. O'Neill was killed in 2017, before I was the district attorney, that there was a lawyer or an investigator or both assigned the case who didn't think that they would be able to prove the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, that had concerns about whether they could overcome defense arguments that might be raised. Now, they made the decision in this case to give those statements by prior assigned lawyers or investigators to the defense lawyers, mm-hmm. to the police union lawyers. I want to be clear about how unusual and unprecedented a decision this is. This is not what we call Brady material. This is not typical evidence that the prosecution gives to the defense. In every case that the DA's office prosecutes, especially cases where there may be challenging proof issues, a murder or a sexual assault or a domestic violence case where we may not have a cooperating survivor of that domestic violence, in every one of those cases, there are conversations internally amongst the investigating team, amongst the lawyers working on the case, about how and whether it's going to be possible to overcome certain defenses that may be raised at trial. Right. And often in those conversations, people express doubts or concerns. Right. Usually it's not a unanimous opinion. People say, well, one person might say, I don't know, that video, they're going to have a strong self-defense argument, or, you know, without a victim testifying, we may not be able to disprove consent, or that's the normal, what we call attorney case product, case
work. Right.
And that's not evidence that gets discovered to the defense in the thousands and thousands of cases that the DA's office prosecutes every year. But in this case, involving a police...
So that is very unusual. And what you described, Chesa Bodine, who is our guest, former district attorney of San Francisco. People meet, you know. I mean, gosh, you can just watch TV if there's any sort of accuracy in lawyership. You see that. But, you know, having been around folks in this profession, yeah, people sit down and you weigh the odds and advantages. But to pass that along to the opposition says a couple of things. One, it underscores why somebody like yourself and around the country, 35 to 40 progressive district attorneys, because this relationship between the district attorney and police has been very uncomfortable. It's very cozy. It's one where obviously you all have to work together, but there still should be the district attorney working on behalf of the people and not on behalf of the police strictly. And so when you see that becomes kind of, I guess, in the mind of some people, the way it should be. Like, hey, I'm going to give these police officers and their lawyer the heads up. I'm going to let them know the doubt, maybe even share with them, you know, some weaknesses so they can exploit that later in trial. That's one thing. The other thing that I think is concerning, and I want to get your comment on this, Chesa, is describing the prosecution of wayward cops who were abusive, as being politically motivated. That's a red herring. And that becomes almost akin to calling people who protest anarchists when they're not. That becomes akin to, you know, labeling folks who are demanding change, who are pushing the levers of power, outside agitators. You know what I mean? You paint the brush and it conjures up in people's minds something that is less than noble and less than sincere. So when I hear this, it sounds like the makings of a playbook that can be exported to other parts of the country, maybe even across the bay with Pamela Price, who, you know, is now looking at cases with police shootings. You can now hear, oh, this was politically motivated and not her looking at the evidence. So your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, look, we know we live in a world where sadly racism is deeply entrenched, where police violence targeting particularly Black and brown men has a shameful history going back to the Deep South, to the Ku Klux Klan, and even before that, to slavery and to the quote-unquote police forces that were used to round up and chase fugitive slaves. So the fact that we still have Tyree Nichols getting beaten down and killed by police, the fact that we still have people like Keita O'Neill here in San Francisco getting shot and killed by police, is not coincidental. It's not accidental. Those are not one-off situations. We have a problem with state violence in this country. And if we don't have district attorneys who are independent enough and courageous enough to stand up and treat all violence equally, to have one standard that we apply when we're evaluating crimes of violence, then we don't have rule of law. Then we are moving dangerously towards fascism. And what I believe, and I think the majority of San Franciscans believe, is that if a police officer uses unlawful force, if they use force in a way that violates the law, they should be prosecuted just like anybody else would be. That is not what DA Jenkins believes. And that's a big problem for us when it comes to justice, integrity, and public safety.
Are there any options if she drops this case? She's dropped this case. What can the family do? Is this something where the feds can jump in? Does Rob Bonta, who is the state attorney general, does he look at this case? Or is this, you know, maybe political alignment with an establishment that doesn't, you know, that's looking at future elections and doesn't want to incur the ire of police unions?
You know, there are options. I mean, first of all, the case has not yet been dismissed. Jenkins said she plans to dismiss it at the next court date, which is March 1st. And, you know, I think we should all demand that she not do that. I think the public should be outraged and should step up and should say this case was filed. It was signed by, the arrest warrant was signed by a judge. You know, we have clear evidence in the form of this video, and that evidence should be presented, and we should move forward. And the second option, the fallback option, is that, as you point out, the Attorney General of the state of California can take over the case. Rob Bonta can take over any case that's being prosecuted anywhere in the state of California. And absolutely, this is a righteous case. This is a meritorious case. And you can never guarantee the outcome of any case. But what you can do is guarantee that our system of justice, that our that our public faith in the equal enforcement of the law will be improved and enhanced if a case like this one that has demanded public attention, commanded public attention for years, that has come this far, if it's allowed to proceed and go through the normal process that any other case involving someone shooting and killing an unarmed human being would go through.
Chesa, can we trust that Brooke Jenkins and people in her office would vigorously prosecute this case? Shouldn't this just automatically be one because of its controversy, because of the proverbial bedfellows, you know, that, you know, the involved parties have become, that it should automatically be kicked, you know, up to the state attorney general or, you know, somebody who is going to be more objective?
I mean, definitely not. We definitely cannot trust Jenkins. She has shown herself to be dishonest, duplicitous, repeatedly throughout her tenure in public life, taking money, claiming she was a volunteer, getting paid by billionaire Republicans and saying she's a volunteer, saying she's progressive and then turning around and trying to prosecute juveniles as adults, saying she believes in drug treatment and then and shutting down all of the treatment programs that exist within the criminal courts, saying she believes in police accountability, and then firing literally every lawyer that I had in the team that was filing these cases and turning around and cooperating with the defense lawyers to come up with excuses and point the finger. So no, we cannot trust her. We cannot trust her office. That being said, these cases need to move forward. And whoever is in charge, they need to be public hearings where the evidence gets presented. And if they're not doing their jobs, they need to be held accountable just like everybody else.
Just as we close out, lines are drawn in the sand on a couple of fronts. One is public perception. And you may have said this, but I'll have you say it just for clarity and so we're on the record with this. What do you say to folks who say, Chess, I'm just so sick of crime. This guy carjacked. You know, this is the reason why I feel unsafe. You know, I read these stories and, you know, the book needs to be thrown at these type of individuals. Maybe it's a visceral anger. Maybe it's a revenge fantasy. But there are people that are listening to this and saying, well, probably deserve to die. How do you respond to that? You know, not so much to the politicians, but to a public that is inundated with stories about, you know, horrific acts of crime, that they just have this anger and really don't care after a certain point.
Yeah, well, first of all, everybody deserves to be safe. And I'm sick and tired of crime, street crime, just like everybody else. I mean, my neighbor's garage got broken into. We've all experienced, directly or indirectly, we've all experienced crime. And I think those are real issues that we all need to form common cause and address in. we don't solve them and we don't move towards a safer, more just community by allowing police to engage in extrajudicial assassinations. We have a court system. We have a police department precisely so that when people do commit crimes, they can be arrested, evidence can be gathered, and a jury of our peers can evaluate the evidence and, if appropriate, impose a criminal conviction. That's the way that this country was founded. Those are the principles that we fought for our independence from England on. And to simply throw them out the window now, after hundreds of years, is reckless, it's anti-democratic, and it's dangerous. So I believe, yes, if you're concerned about crime, I share that concern. I fought for years as district attorney and before to do whatever I could to make San Francisco safer. And you know what? If you look at the statistics, violent crime is at historic lows right now. Doesn't mean that we don't have work to do, and it doesn't mean anything if you or someone you love has been a victim of crime. But it does mean that using the law, I mean, look, I'm a lawyer. I believe in the rule of law. I believe that we have process and that we have constitutional rights, and that when we vigorously enforce those rights, we as a community are more democratic, more just, and safer and stronger as a result.
And last question, what do you tell people who are supportive of the efforts that you undertook and you know, supportive of what you've been speaking out on? What are their marching orders moving forward?
Well, look, in terms of this case, I mean, I think people should be paying very close attention to what happens on March 1st. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of people in the courtroom, in front of the courthouse, demanding that justice be done and that justice carry forward and that the case not be dismissed. So I think people should show up on March 1st at the courthouse, Hall of Justice. I think people should also organize. Look, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, what matters more than who is in a particular elected office, whether it's me or DA Jenkins, what matters the most is that we have social movements, that we have grassroots community groups that are demanding the kinds of changes in our community that we believe will make us stronger and more just. And creating that pressure and that political space for positive change is critical, and it's more critical now than ever.
That's the voice of Chesa Boudin, former San Francisco District Attorney. We will keep our eyes and ears out for that March 1st court date around the police killing of Kedda O'Neill. And we will see if the current DA, Brooke Jenkins, will prosecute the case. And I'm sure a lot of people who are concerned will do everything they can to see that justice is served. So thank you for joining us, Chesa. We will talk to you soon.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, North, South, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Round Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from this hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor God. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor God. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
Today on Hard Knock Radio, we bring you The Healing Project, a multimedia installation that features personal stories from those who are incarcerated and highlights the deep trauma that imprisonment has had on their lives and their loved ones. When you walk into The Healing Project at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco, you see a piano centered in the middle of a huge space, connected to three smaller rooms. There's sound coming from every direction. People's voices talking about their life experiences with prisons. There's an altar against one wall, draped with prayer beads, white candles, dried flowers, and bottles of alcohol. Above it is a mural of a person crowned with flowers, their faces in a silhouette, but somehow feels like you can look into their eyes.
Welcome to the Healing Project. This is basically just the title wall. Obviously, for like any type of exhibition, you have the title wall, which is like an introduction context for people to understand what they're going to experience. And so we wanted to try to write it like from a personal perspective. So all this language here is just basically from my artist statement of like trying to explain why I tried to create the project and what's inside of it. Obviously, the heart of the project is in the interviews, some of which you'll hear, that we did across the country with folks who have experienced structural violence from a series of different contexts, talking to them about what they went through, but also about the healing practices. And it's like a combination, like sound, visuality, language. We're trying to kind of basically cover all the bases. So these right here at the beginning, these are tapes that have short interviews on them from different folks that are incarcerated.
That's some more interviews. The Bay Area raised composer, pianist, singer, and activist. He has spent the past 8 years exploring structures of systemic racism, specifically how many families navigate the daily realities of state violence and the systems of detention and incarceration in the United States. He comes from a family with a long history of social and racial justice activism. His father, Howard Penderhughes, was an organizer in the anti-apartheid movement as a student at UC Berkeley. He later went on to work with violence prevention organizations and is an active member of the Brotherhood of Elders Network. His mother, Raquel Penderhughes, is also an activist. Fighting for environmental and racial justice, supporting solidarity movements in Latin America, and creating programs to support incarcerated youth and adults while also fighting to abolish the prison industrial complex. Penderhughes follows in his parents' footsteps. He wants the Healing Project to lift up the voices of those who have been locked up and silenced, to not only show the world that this flawed system should be abolished, but to also show support for people who've experienced structural violence.
Telling the truths about the violences of the current system and the true need to basically eradicate it, not to reform it, and being like super honest about how it affects people. And then on the other side, actually showing what type of other world is possible and what people actually need in their day-to-day if they're gonna actually be the healthiest versions of themselves. The piece that I always talk about first or think about first is a piece that is narrated and spoken by my brother Keith Lamar, who's incarcerated in Ohio on death row. And it's called Sweet, and it's basically like a piece where he discusses his experience not just being incarcerated, but even growing up previous to that as a very young person, because he was incarcerated very young. But basically the thesis of it is he's talking about the thing that he's the most proud of throughout his whole time of his life is that he's maintained and held on to his sweetness, because every level from his childhood and growing up in this country to, obviously being incarcerated, everything is designed to rob him of that sweetness and to kind of make him unfeeling, make him like hard and all this stuff. And he's just like, I always hold on to that sweet part of myself. And then he talks about also the people around him that help him maintain that and support that part of him. And I love that because, obviously, number one, I really believe in that so much, and that we all need to hold on to that and be able to hold on to that. But also because I think it directly contradicts the image that one wants to paint of somebody on death row.
Penderhughes walks me to a room with words on the wall that read, "They chew you up, swallow you." Audio is playing of a man named Keith Lamar describing how he holds on to his humanity despite being incarcerated.
I mean, one of the things that I'm surprised about, and my friends tell me this, people who that really know me, that's kind of still kind of surprising to me. I'm sweet, man. I mean, I love being sweet to my friends, and when I was younger, when I was growing up, that wasn't cool to be sweet. I remember the little sweet little boy I was. And by sweet, I mean I just like to make connection with people. I like that tenderness, just the human thing, to connect with people on. But this situation, when we talk about the criminal justice system, really what it is a digestive system. a digestive tract. You know, they chew you up with that education.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional facility and may be recorded and monitored.
You know, they chew you up with that education, swallow you, and, you know, you go in the stomach, the large, small intestines, and then you come out as a piece of... So one of the things I've been kind of most amazed about myself that I've been able to hold on to my sweetness, you know, my sense of, you know, that's one of the things I most like about myself. But only people that are really close to me that kind of know, you know, because you have to have the opportunity to, you know, well, I'm sweet to myself as well. I'm good to myself, you know, even after all I've been through. And, you know, that's one of the things that I want people to know, that even in, like, even if your worst fears come true, you know, nothing, you know, but death itself can rob you of who you really are. Nothing. You know, like, you know, I can be myself, you know, God gave me, understand. One of my close friends told me a long time ago, he said, you know, Bomani, life can be had no matter where you are. You can still laugh in prison. You can still cry in prison. You can still, you know, be who you are, where you are. Yeah. That's what I think I'm most proud about. And everything that I've accomplished, man, is that I've been able to hold on to that, you know, sense of sweetness in myself. Yeah.
Keith Lamar was sentenced to prison at the age of 19 for murder. He has spent over 30 years in prison, most of it in solitary confinement. The Healing Project forces us to acknowledge the deep problems in America's so-called system of corrections and rehabilitation. Penderhughes exposes the system's focus on forced servitude, imprisonment, and punishment, and its failure to consider the futures of those re-entering society and the impacts on their families and communities.
A prison is like, I mean, it's like an embassy. That's the only way I can think of it. It's like they don't have to follow the rules of the governing land. You know what I'm saying? They just have their own, they just have their own policies, and there's no one there to say it's not okay.
I think that, you know, so much of the way after the prison is conditioning, right? The conditioning to see oneself as inferior. Conditioning to bring people, conditioning to try to have people be less of themselves, right? And I'm very intentional and very habitual about this for myself, is that I refuse to walk with my head down. I refuse not to look somebody in the eye. and when I see somebody do that, you know, I definitely point it out to them, like, not heads up.
You know, so it's kind of like, you know, there's nothing good that's going to come out of this situation except for me leaving this place. Titles like inmate, convict, ex-felon, they're demeaning titles. They're put in place to diminish self-respect and dignity, and to demean you and your character and break your spirit. And I believe this is all connected with the billion-dollar industrial prison complex.
How do we capture? They have conferences where they get together and they think really hard about how to make a better cage. And then they sell their products to them and they implement it on us. Caging.
Thank you for using TTL.
The Healing Project is a haunting tapestry of instrumentation and stories about the cruel nature of prison. Each interviewee offers truth and vulnerability about their experiences in hopes of expressing their pain and bringing attention to the inhumane realities of prison. The Healing Project shows the deep trauma that the prison system causes for families and the long journey of healing that must take place. Walking through the exhibition, I enter a dark grayish room with images of men and women being projected off the wall, recorded voices of people talking about the challenges that come after incarceration.
This is why I need to try to get my record expunged, man, because I'm always face these barriers, you know, especially if I'm trying to get some property, I'm trying to do something like that. I'm always facing these barriers, you know, so, you know, I still feel that pain, you know, of being disenfranchised, man, being civilly dead.
No one wants to give you a home. No one wants to give you a place to stay because they think or feel you're going to be a problem just because you've been in jail and prison. You're going to have the wrong people. You're going to have too much coming in or out there. You know, these are all the assumptions that they make up. Yeah, about people that's been in prison when really all we want to do is get a place to stay, get some stability, and get on with our lives. But it's hard to, and since I know what that mentality and mindset is, it's hard to
talk to somebody
about these resources that you have when it's basically you selling pipe dreams when all they want is a place to stay. And a place to stay here right now is hard for anybody. 6 months to a year to find permanent housing. So what are they supposed to do in between that time? Do you think that they hear about doing the right things when they just trying to live to survive? Nobody wants to take those penitentiary chances out there day to day. But sometimes that's what people are forced with, and especially if you're a mother with children.
Nobody wants to take those penitentiary chances. Nobody wants to take those penitentiary chances.
Now I'm in a blue-lit room. I can hear interviewees talking about the psychological warfare of prison and the trauma they experienced.
It's basically like a mixtape. So like, I took all the interviews, cut them up, brought them to different producers, and then I basically like made a few different pieces with each of the producers. So there's, it's like, each of the pieces are about 5 minutes, 3 to 5 minutes, and they're on loop. So it's basically like, if you stay for however long you stay, you're getting that amount, but if you were to come in at a different time, you might hear something totally different, you know.
Civilized people don't live like this. This is the way animals live. This is animals. I'm not an animal. 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 A prison is like, I mean, it's like an embassy. That's the only way I could think of it. It's like they don't have to follow the rules of the governing land. You know what I'm saying? They just have their own, they just have their own policies, and there's no one there to say it's not okay. So you can buck against the system, but they've got it in place. I mean, it's literally just like slavery. You can run, but if we catch your ass, this was gonna happen. So they let you see the folks who kick up against, you know what I'm saying, the system. And they parade them around, handcuffed, new dummy box, little spit mask on, just, whew. It's psychological warfare. And this bottom line is what it is. It's psychological warfare. And it has broken many people.
Sitting in the blue room, feeling the vibration of the woofers strategically planted underneath the bench, you cannot escape the raw and painful stories of people who could be your brother, your student, your neighbor, your friend, or even you.
If a person is coming in here that's 15, they have to hear that they
has a resume
with.
Yeah.
But then also we have strings. And we have, like, if a person comes in that's 60, it's gonna be something for them too. You know? All original production music from like me and like 20 other cats, like all around New York. And then we mixed it specifically for surround sound for the space. So there's different parts of it coming out of every speaker.
Right, right. I saw it in the mic. I said, okay, I know.
Maximum impact.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, maximum
impact. Many people who enter the carceral system bring a series of traumatic experiences with them, including a lifetime of dealing with micro and macro level racism and oppression. Incarceration only adds to the trauma, which is oftentimes generational.
Prison in California and out behind my father. Like, I kind of grew up in the prisons, like where the prison guards kind of knew me and my mom. My dad wrote me letters since I was born, and he would always open the letter with the same phrase. You know, and I never wrote back.
because I was a kid. So I just expected my dad to write these letters, and he always did. He always remembered my birthday. He always remembered any dates that were important. He was good with dates. So he would write and say, oh yeah, you did this today. That's the relationship I had with him. And just all in my head, I had this fantasy about what I wanted him to be to me. And he just never could. You know, I seen my dad 10 months clean before he died. And I hurried up and went and took photographs. You know, he wasn't there for me or my sister when we were born, but he got to see Eric born with me. You know, he got to see my son.
These transparent conversations have similar heartbreaking themes. Families torn apart and lost time. One part of the project is made up of over 100 powerful testimonies and an LP titled Grief, created by those who've been locked up. Penner Hughes has put these interviews together with songs. I sat with him to talk more about the messages in the music. He told me about one song in particular that best describes the project, titled Process.
I would say probably Process. You know, I would say that that song definitely builds it, because I think that that song represents this idea that, you know, the key to moving through all of this in real time is understanding that we're not going to get through it tomorrow. It's not going to get better tomorrow. That's just the reality. So in that context, we do the best we can, and we recalibrate our expectations of what healing looks like, that it is not like a competitive triumph over one's demons or whatever one's going through. It's trying every day to make it a little bit better. And it's trying every day to extend grace to yourself in the way that you would to the person that you love, you know. And I think that that's a very important part for those that are going through those things. And that is, at the end of the day, what the project is made for. I want everyone to experience it, but the project is made for those that's going through the things.
There's some things that I don't want. So I try not to think about it. So there's a lot of ugly things in my heart. I just hope to the Lord I don't slip. You feel me? So there's some things that I don't want. So I try not to think about it. There's a lot of ugly things in my heart. I just hope to the Lord I don't slip. I wonder what it's like to let it out. That part of me that I'm so afraid of. It holds on me and tosses me about. Doesn't seem to be something I get away from. Tell me, how do you name those well-kept secrets that you never say out loud? And why does the body see these demons but keep me from calling out? I guess I'll just say it's a process, one day at a time.
Penner Hughes highlights the harsh realities of the prison system, the traumatic experiences it causes for entire families, and the difficult long road to healing. He knows that the songs in the Healing Project are intense. He's pushing his audience to connect with those who are unseen and feel their undeniable pain and sorrow.
So there's a whole entire world that I've created in my mind.
The Healing Project is asking, so how do we survive America? What does it mean to maintain one's humanity while dealing with the trauma of relentless systemic racism?
I don't really believe that true healing can exist in this type of capitalist society, because the whole society is built on exploitation. So it does not exist without exploitation. There's no way for it to exist. And that's another function of the prison, is that the prison is where we put all the people that would show us how much society has failed. You know, it's like, you don't want to look at how this capitalist system has created a problem with so many people being unhoused, or has created the problem with so many people losing their mortgage, or so many people, you know, not being able to have a job. It's like, y'all did this, but you don't want to look at it. So then you're going to take everybody and put them and lock them up, you know?
Penny Hughes believes that it's possible to support alternatives to our draconian prison system, while also recognizing that people are complicated.
I definitely try to be very conscious of saying this project is not a project about innocence. Like, a lot of the people that are a part of the project have done different things, you know, but they're also some of the kindest, most brilliant, most loving individuals I've ever met. And when you get deep into them dealing with and talking about why those things happen and where they are now, number one, they're actually evidence of what a real process of accountability can look like, because they've actually moved through these processes in a way that few of us have. And definitely not because the prison did that for them, but because they did it themselves in spite of their conditions.
In The Healing Project, Penderhue shines a light on the fact that true rehabilitation and healing cannot happen within systems built to enforce oppression and structural racism. He puts faces, voices, and humanity to people behind bars. He wants to see systemic change and stop the cycles of increased trauma and harm. His vision for the future is filled with hope for stronger organizing efforts to dismantle the prison industrial complex. He puts this energy into his music.
Hope, I wrote, I think that was the last song I wrote for the record, and it was something I wanted to represent of, like, I often get a, you know, I often get response from people of like, oh man, your work is like so dark, it's so like heavy and whatever, and I'm like, yeah, well, that's what I'm thinking about. But so I kind of titled it that, like, as a kind of a cheeky thing, like, hey, well, here you go. But, you know, obviously it's not like a purely happy-go-lucky song, but to me it does represent what hope means to me, which, as I said, hope is a discipline. And I think for me it represents this era of, you know, for some people, the things that are going on is not a reality we can check in and out of. But I think for a lot of other folks, you know, a lot of white folks, a lot of rich folks, a lot of different people, you know, you can check in and out of the fight depending on when it's comfortable for you to be there and how you feel about, you know, how guilty are you today. That's going to make determine whether you would participate or not. And so I wanted to do a song that challenged that and said, like, you know, you can't just, if you really want to represent hope, you can't just say, oh, hope means I just gonna hope it gets better. No, you have to participate, and you have to realize that it's not gonna just go away because you wish it away. It's only gonna go away if we organize.
You told me the war is over, while everything's for sale, it's all in a good performance. Yes, you pretend to care, hide the weapons, it's all for the crowd. You wanna believe so badly that everything was safe. Don't nobody lose a fortune, it works for you. It's awfully loud in here, 'cause Jesse still owes his rent now, and Bree is working for 500 cents, and she is still calling collect now. Can't believe in what you say when I see this. Can't believe of the preachers, when your whole existence is illegal, while we wash up all the blood of the people. Wash up all the blood, and I can't hear it all.
One of the most powerful things about The Healing Project is the community of creators that have created it with me. It's almost 100 different people between folks who are narrators who have shared their stories, visual creators, artwork, music, and this is very much of a collective project. And the best part of it, I think, is that hopefully when people step into the space, whether it's digitally, whether it's physically, they will feel that collective notion. They'll feel that thing of, this is a group of folks that have come together to try to really almost create an artistic rendition of them being around a dinner table talking to each other about these things, but from all around the country. And my hope is that when people will step into it, they will feel like they need to give themselves into that. You know, I don't want them to think, oh, I'm gonna take something away. I want them to give themselves to it, you know? So that's my hope for how people will approach it. And I would say the other secondary one would just be, I think the other powerful thing about it is the practical tools that people can get away from it. If they're really listening to the pieces in the sound room, I really believe that people will be able to have physical, practical tools that they can take away for when they go through grieving process, when they're dealing with something that's really hard, when they've experienced, you know, some type of trauma and they're trying to heal from it, they'll have practical things they can do.
This project functions as an abolitionist narrative. It calls for an end to the current prison system. It urges us to create new ways of addressing conflict and processes that are more humane. In February of 2023, Samora Penahues was awarded a $1 million grant from the Mellon Foundation in further support of the Healing Project. Funding will go towards the expansion of artworks in the Healing Project exhibition, the creation of a book, free community programs, and the creation of new content. The grant also provides the initial funding for the Healing Project Transformative Impact Fund, which will offer seed money and mentorship for selected interviewees who are currently or formerly incarcerated to work on their own special projects. All work is based on the premise that the deepest healing strategies come directly from those who have been traumatized and oppressed. To learn more about the Healing Project and listen to audio stories, visit us at radioproject.org. I've been your host, Anita Johnson, and you've been listening to Making Contact.
Yes, you pretend to care. Hide the weapons, it's all for the crowd. You wanna believe so badly that everything was safe. Don't nobody lose a fortune, it works for you. It's awfully loud in here. Cause Jesse still owes his rent now, and Bree is working for 500 cents, and she is still calling collect now. Can't believe in what you say when I see this. Can't believe in all the words of the preachers when your whole existence is illegal. While we wash up all the blood of the people, wash up all the blood,
wash up all the blood.
While we try to build a room for our freedom,
for our freedom,
we build what they destroy. We wash up all the blood, and I can't hear it all.
Don't stop, EMN at it again. C stimulating ill conversation. Anything else is just imitation, simulation. Step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go.
Big shout out to Nita and Davey D.
Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah.
Honing down at Hard Knock Radio. Kind of crazy though. Oakland, stand up.
Stand up.
Ensemble, Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on.
Check out.
Why every knob is they Hard Knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost for the fee? Ain't nothing they made, they beats trying to eat till they're ready for the steel gray beef. Say, please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making his peace. Say, some peace to their lovers, I name with a please. Maybe some shade on your name in the street. Because it ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio.
You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coach. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Let's go.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporate